Pit Hog, Penny Hog, Mr. and Mrs. Hog.
Who are they?
At home with the hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hog.
Weekend to you, and welcome home with Pen and I
here
at Home with the Hogs. Let's drop the music a little bit, shall we? Couldn't hear ourselves think. Yes, 2 hours of conversation, music and satire. This is Talk Radio Europe's magazine programme dedicated to the perspective of our lives together here in Spain.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Having a good one. It's beautiful out there.
A dazzling day, yes.
So a bit of a retina splitter, actually, isn't it? Straight through the eyeball first thing in the morning.
Yeah, particularly driving. Yeah, up that slope where the sun just sits in the middle of the road and you can't see a thing. Actually, this is not at home with the hogs. It's at home with the groundhogs, because I'm about to say exactly what I said exactly a week ago.
And what was that?
Here we go. This is the show that this morning connects you not only with your inner Spain, remember that bit, but also that sense of adventure, the smell of the open road, as we unleash a travel special here at Home with the Hogs. At 11:40, trail guide and author Guy Hunter-Watts reviews a gorgeous new book just launched by the renowned travel publisher Cicerone.
And I'm going to be talking about...
No, darling, no. Tell us more about Cicerone.
Celebrates. I've already said this, but let's...
Well, you said it last week, but okay. People don't remember.
No, well...
Last week, incidentally, in case you weren't here, we had a problem with the phone, so none of our guests came through. So we're attempting to rechannel them this week, hence the groundhog thing.
Yes, and you won't have to listen to us freestyling, as it were. Anyway, 11:40, trail guide and author Guy Hunter-Watts reviews a gorgeous new book just launched by the renowned travel publisher Cicerone.
No, Cicerone.
Well, I think it's Cicerone.
Well, we'll ask Guy. I think you'll find it's Cicerone, actually, yeah?
Let's not row on air. It celebrates 50 years of adventure from 1969 to 2019. And, in conjunction with Guy, we'll be offering you a copy of this stunning compendium of worldwide walks with an exciting competition.
A literary exercise, the winner of which not only receives a copy of Cicerone's celebration of 50 years of adventure, but an invitation from Pen and I, humbly beseeching you to read your winning entry on the show.
Okay.
At 12:40 today, we tell the story of another journey to another kingdom, a place that is so remote you may not even have heard its name, unless you were listening last week when we mentioned it. Deep in the Himalayan snows on the very border of Nepal and Tibet, at the head of the previously forbidden Mustang Valley, is a land called Lomantang. With my very own brother Gavin, who's recently returned from Lomantang, and he joins us from Wales, diffusing, no doubt, the audial aura of the humongous Himalayas. That's at about 22:01 today. Babes, arbalistas, palms, trees and gardens, shortly after midday, we've got a special guest, haven't we?
We have Jay Dedinia is going to be talking to us. Well, he's the pool doctor. And if you have pool problems, Jay's your man. I'm not sure whether will we be able to ring in with any pool problems talking to Jay, or is he just...
Well, we don't actually have a pool, do we? So we don't have any problems at all in that direction.
No. And, well, I think the question, do you ever actually see people swimming in their pools?
We could ask him that,
yeah,
whether they're just a sort of item of decoration or whether actually people even use their swimming pools. I've never seen, I've seen one one goose pimple woman in Sotto Grande recently swimming in her swimming pool.
Well, I'm not surprised. It is January.
Anyway, that's Dr. Dedena, the pool medic, at around 12:05.
Okay, and then we're going to be talking about the dreaded processionary caterpillar.
Oh, of course, yes, it's that time of year again.
It is that time of year, and they're ever prevalent, and they're still here.
So. Ever prevalent, yep. It's been a while, but this morning also we're going to be talking about cars.
Oh, yes.
Because without them, where would you be?
Well, you wouldn't have got here this morning, that's
for
sure.
You'd be at the bus stop, wouldn't you? And in the camper where there aren't any buses, you'd be hitching, and whatever happened to hitching. But that's a story for another day. Meantime, let's embrace the reality that in rural Spain, at least, you need wheels. A fact that occurred to me with some urgency recently as I watched our cars waving goodbye on their way to the scrapyard. Our morning story in about 20 minutes' time is Adios a los coches de antes. Yes, and we're on the starting pad, and that's the burble of a big V8 you can hear.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Let's talk about food, and in particular, indifferent meals. Have you had one recently? No, not at home, not in your kitchen, but out at a restaurant or a bar, which in Spain one assumes will be a pleasurable experience. But is it necessarily? 952-784-1000 if you want to join the discussion. Restaurants in Spain? Room for improvement? Let's talk to Pengi.
Well, yesterday I went for a meal out because I thought, no, I won't take some food with me from the home because I'll be able to eat something. And the day before, I'd done the same thing. So I'm not vegetarian, but I don't particularly eat pork. But if you go to a restaurant which advertises food and it all looks quite delicious from the outside and you sit down and say, yes, I'll have a salad then. Why I don't learn, I don't know, but I should always learn to expect, and there's always hope, more than a big white plate with half an iceberg lettuce. And this time, it was a whole tomato chopped into quarters. That was it.
Now, I am going to play devil's advocate here, because you are a bit of a fussy eater. You're a bit of a nightmare to cater for, aren't you?
Says he. Well,
no, I eat, and you normally take a small Tupperware container of some sordid little snack. But just recently, you've decided to explore the big wide world of Spanish restaurants and bars.
Yeah, and I'm not doing it again.
And you're not.
I am not ever doing. Well, later on, when a good restaurant to me. If you're going to do meat, do it well. If you're going to offer a salad, do it well. But that's not a salad. So the next day I thought, okay, I'll try a salad here, different restaurant, probably about 4 miles from the other. And so you sit down, and this time it was a salad, yeah, which was actually, the lettuce was chopped up smaller, that's something.
Yes.
But it had the most indescribable, very, very vinegary vinaigrette on top of it, which just made your mouth burn, and two pieces of chicken. I thought, what could possibly go wrong?
Oh, was it called a chicken salad?
No, it wasn't. They were this sort of laying next to the salad, and that was a chicken breast. You think, yeah, okay, but just very thin slices of extremely dry chicken, and that was it. So I'm not doing that again.
Rubbery chicken. The salad have a can of tuna tipped on the top of it?
No, mostly.
Okay.
No.
Right.
I think that would have been called something. That would be ensalada mixta. Rather
I do than, agree with you that I think there's so many restaurants, particularly down here, probably less so, in my experience, less so further north, where people just don't have a duende around food. They're just not believing in what they do. They're just serving up any old bland nonsense. And it is bland.
Why is it? I mean, maybe is it just because we're in Andalusia, things are very slow to change. But I think, so if you were to go around the corner to, say, Tarifa, I think there's vegan, there's vegetarian, there's Thai restaurants. Yes, I think that's okay. I mean, I could be just going to the wrong places.
Yes, I think there is an innovative school of thinking that draws from foreign influences. But I think we need to distinguish between that and traditional Spanish fare. Okay. And I think traditional Spanish fare is in danger of, in my experience, becoming rather unexceptional, a bit of a rut. I mean, how often do you go for tapas and they are the same old tapas?
Well, exactly. Well, I looked recently.
Let's say Russian salad, albondigas.
Albondigas. We can translate these kind of meatballs, which is a good nickname for somebody if you happen to know somebody.
Yeah, there was an unfortunate girl, wasn't there?
Albondiga. Are meatballs, which I've actually got usually served in a small clay dish with a little cracker called a pico on the side.
In a tomato sauce.
Yes, may get one or two meatballs as a tapa, and they will be smothered in most delicious sauce. Especially delicious are the meatballs with almond sauce. They're rich and satisfying on a cold winter night. No, yeah, I could eat that.
No one's saying there isn't such a thing as a good meatball. It's just you don't run into one very often.
No. Okay, well, what about, how do you feel about blood pudding? Morcilla.
A morcilla. I'm generally excited about morcilla.
You're excited about morcilla.
I love morcilla. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily always agree with me. My friend Jacobo says morcilla se repete, which means it repeats on you,
and it does
relentlessly during the course of the day. Don't eat it too late, eat too much.
Those croquetes.
I love croquetas. Yes, and a good croqueta takes a bit of beating. It's a sort of breadcrumb. It's like a pupa, a cocoon of potato with a filling wrapped up in breadcrumbs, deep fried, it's normally a safe option. Normally pretty digestible. But again, you know, it's flavour we want. It's something with a bit of belief, something that isn't necessarily bland that we want. Ensalada de pimiento. Again, you know, it's peppers in a salad with normally fine. But why don't we have some new tapas? Where are the new tapas? Where are the innovators that are coming along?
I think you get better Spanish tapas in the UK than you do in Spain.
I wouldn't know about that.
Tapas bravas are like those that... I think one of my favourites is Cajos.
Oh, you're lying.
I am lying.
Tell us what Cajos are.
Oh, well, it's tripe.
Right.
The Cajos is
that's the stomach wall of a pig.
Well, yeah, in Madrid, this dish is cooked slowly in a spicy sauce along with gorgeous chickpeas and makes for a perfect little stew to enjoy on a chilly night. The local says, we are sure that if you try this tapa, you'll be soaking up the sauce with a bit of bread after you've finished. But then actually after that, they suggest chorizo a la sidra. Now that might be quite nice, which is chorizo cooked in cider.
Okay, yeah, sounds like an Asturian dish. Yeah. I was in Avila a couple of weeks ago and had... I think actually tapas are a very good way of sampling local cuisine without getting stuck into a whole meal.
Avoiding a whole meal, yeah.
And particularly if you're on your own, sitting at a restaurant, having a whole meal being served, it's really unnecessary. So the bar thing is much better. You're sitting on a stool, you're making conversation, you're watching the telly, you would probably topple off your stool. But there's a table tables as well, babe. And I had a bowl of pig's ears. Just a little one. They tasted just like pig's ears, really. You could imagine them. I do think that what we're saying about food is also echoed that in a magazine which I occasionally buy. It's called Tinta Libre. It's a sort of left of centre magazine with a monthly theme. It's a collection of essays, some more digestible than others. And this week's theme was Spanish cuisine. The most readable of the essays was headlined Cocina Española, Nuestros Cinco Errores Capitales, our five main mistakes. And they list complacency as being number one.
Right.
That there's the kind
general
of
lack of interest.
Kind of the idea that that Spanish cuisine has reached a pinnacle with Bully Restaurant and the Michelin star, the top end, and that the innovation, the inventiveness has somehow dried up. And allied with that, and they're all interlinked, these reasons, is a degree of predictability.
Yeah.
And I think you feel that particularly if you go for a menu del dia, you kind of know what you're going to get
Sopa de Marisco.
Yeah. Ensalada mixed to Sopa de Marisco. There's gazpacho and some morejos sometimes. And then the main dish will be something piggy or something fishy. And then puddings, unfailingly, flan or cheesecake. Or Macedonia, yeah. Yes. Or an apple, actually, which is a bit of a cop-out.
Sounds like my sort of puddings, yeah. Macedonia.
You were about to ask a question about an apple, were you? Or no, Macedonia, you were saying.
Yes, Macedonia. Why is it called Macedonia?
I have no idea. It's from Macedonia, probably, which is a can of fruit salad, obviously. And the other thing that this article berated Spanish cuisine for was a lack of... That very often the same thing is served regardless of season. And I don't think you've got to look much further than that, than a salad.
Mm. You're absolutely right. I remember last year being in a bar rather than a restaurant in Gaucin, on the north side of Gaucin. There was literally cloud coming through the door. It was freezing cloud coming through the door. No sense of shutting the door because I suppose in the bar would look closed. And so I thought, I'll have some nice warming stew or something. Guess what I got? A salad. A friend of mine just whispered. He said, well, you think they'd come up with something warming, wouldn't you? But on a good note, what about a calçotada? Now, in Tarragona or Barcelona, there's something called a calçot.
Yes.
Now, it's a seasonal vegetable similar to a leek or a spring onion that grows in the area near Barcelona and Tarragona. Mm. And then normally eaten from January through till April. And the best way to try them is cooked on a barbecue, accompanied by a romesco sauce, local wine, and a group of friends. So if you're in Catalonia and you want to enjoy your very own calçotada, but don't have access to your own barbecue, don't worry. Because luckily, there are places to find merenderos, or picnic areas, close to the city, as well as vineyards, which have barbecues all set up. They supply the barbecue, firewood, and tables, and you just bring what you want to eat and drink, which sounds actually quite cool. In the case of wineries, you're expected to buy their wine. So, to prepare the calçotes, it couldn't be easier. There's no need to clean them or cut the roots off. Simply place them on the barbecue, in like you would a sardine. Squish them. Excuse me.
Okay, so we're looking at a vegetable that is halfway between a leek and an onion. Did you say?
Yes. Yeah. Sort of quite big, messy looking, sort of enormous spring onions. There's really nothing that remarkable about them. Mm-hmm. Just onions, quite slithery, and unlike meat and other vegetables, which cook best over hot embers, they can be cooked while they're still flames in the barbecue. You don't have to wait for that.
Oh, so you char them.
Yes. And after about 5 minutes, you will see bubbles of juice escaping through the blackened outer leaves, signaling that they are ready and to be eaten and cooked. Wrap them in newspaper and carry them to the table to your excited guests, and you get your sauce from, you can get them from pretty much any greengrocer if you're wondering, if you've seen them in supermarkets. The romesco sauce is specifically for the calçots, and the traditional way to eat them is to peel off the blackened outer layer, dip the inner part in the sauce, lift the calçot above your head so it hangs down vertically, tip your head back and lower the calçot into your mouth.
I'm picturing it, yes.
Be warned, it's a pretty messy business.
Do we know what the sauce is?
Well, I just said it's romesco sauce.
Yes, darling, but what is romesco sauce?
It's almonds, garlic, sounds quite tasty, and tomato, sort of whizzed up. I think there's all sorts of different versions, but yes, I think that's probably similar to that chiri-chiri that you put on our...
Calçot.
Yes.
Okay, we were going to talk about Spaniards in winter, but it's much more interesting, I think, to talk about sex. Sex in Franco's Spain. Was there any?
Well, I'd like to read a little... this is a complete change of subject here. I'd like to read something from a book written by John Hooper. It's called The Spaniards, A Portrait of the New Spain. And I think you can still get it. It was published in 1986. And this is a little reading on it. It does it in chapters. This is The Sexual Revolution. And this is from page 186. The occasional excesses of Spain's sexual revolution are a measure of the intensity of the repression which preceded it. Alone of the countries of southern Europe, Spain has been subject in recent years to a special double oppression. In the same way as the other Catholic countries of the Mediterranean, she had been subject to the doctrines of a religion which, ever since St. Paul, have been deeply suspicious of physical enjoyment of any kind. To the monks and nuns in charge of many of Spain's private schools, the penis was a diabolic serpent and the vagina, Satan's den. There is, of course, a direct link between attitudes of this sort and the Spaniards' traditional enthusiasm for the mortification of the flesh. As Monsieur Escrivia, the founder of Opus Dei, wrote, "If you know that your body is your enemy and the enemy of God's glory, why do you treat it so gently?" Sex was strictly for the purpose of procreation within wedlock. Premarital contact between the sexes was kept to a minimum by the strictures attached to courtship. Incredible as it may seem now, the Church had great difficulty in agreeing to any form of physical contact between novias, which is boyfriend and girlfriend. As late as 1959, the Spanish bishops' Norms of Christian Decency stated unequivocally that novias walking along arm in arm cannot be accepted. A friar, Quintin San Saliegos, writing in the early 60s, had reconciled himself to the fact that the novias would not only touch their novias, but may even kiss them. But he
Girlfriend or boyfriend.
Yes, but he offered this advice. Whenever you kiss a man, remember your last communion and think to yourself, could the sacred host and the lips of this man come together on my lips without sacrilege?
Mm. And of course, there was a payback here, wasn't there? Because there was a huge, huge prostitution scene.
Yeah, there was something like 500,000 prostitutes in Spain at that time.
In Franco's Spain. Mm. Well, you had to go somewhere, I guess. So yes. It's sort of and how legal was prostitution in Franco's Spain?
It was pretty. It wasn't illegal. It was ignored.
It was grey area.
But there's another just a little bit here. Mm. Under the Church's guidance, censorship attained extraordinary heights of Puritanism. Professional boxing matches were kept out of newsreels on the grounds that they meant showing naked male torsos. Photographs of the bouts did appear in the press, but with vests painted in by the retocadores, or the retouchers, who were employed by every newspaper and magazine up until the 50s. Among their other duties was to reduce the size of women's breasts. In later years, producers at TVE had to keep a shawl handy in case a starlet turned up for a show with a dress that was too décolleté.
No. Right, so there was a whole breed of people who were put out of work in the late 50s, retocadores, people who touched up photos. Yes. Fascinating. Yes. After the break, our morning story, Adios a los coches de antes.
This is Talk Radio Europe.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Time for our morning story. Are you sitting comfortably? Good. Car lover or not, and I am a car lover, it's a painful experience watching yours drown and fill with mud in the flood that flushed us out of house and home last October. And then have to contemplate both of them, corpsed, dejected, filthy and hopeless, like mementos of an abject defeat, whose pain is all the more acute in the realisation that one of them was only 6 weeks old, with just 5,000 kilometres on the clock, a beautiful blue Toyota Hilux. Luckily, and thanks to Penn, both the Hilux and her old Lexus were comprehensively insured, and in the forthcoming and inevitable wrangle with the insurers, for a heady moment we were given to believe that they would pay out full value without appropriating the cars themselves. And in this moment, with the possibly naive objective of restoration, we began shovelling out the mud and stripping the seats and upholstery from the Hilux in preparation. but the insurers were clever. They offered us just 80% of the value. The rest, the balance, came independently from a scrapyard, which was, oddly, over 1,000 kilometres away, in the Asturias. That the scrapyard was this distant was surprising, even ridiculous, except in marked contrast to the insurers who took 7 weeks to pay us anything, the desguace, the scrapyard in Las Asturias, sent us their share of the payout within just 7 days, without any apparent need to see the cars, all done over the phone with a woman called Marisol. Money, paperwork, and yes, they would come down and collect the vehicles. That she left this detail slightly vague at the time didn't bother us a bit. They'd paid us, the cars were there when they wanted, and with other things to do, we abandoned any aspirations of restoring the Hilux. We'd sold it to them anyway. The cars were, of course, over their axles in silt, something we remedied with a digger towing them up to the highest part of the finca, a flat area called the helicopter pad. And there they sat in their sadness, awaiting their last journey to dismemberment in the Asturias. In fairness, I had mentioned to Marisol that we lived 4 kilometres up a dirt track, the other side of 3 arroyos, a detail that possibly she'd overlooked in her zeal to complete the deal. A suspicion that was confirmed just the other day during a phone call from a man called Enrique. Enrique, a truck driver, had been dispatched by Marisol to collect our vehicles in a full-size 2-story semi-trailer car transporter, and he wanted to know, would this Thursday be convenient? Why, yes, of course. I then explained to Enrique something that perhaps Marisol might have failed to mention, that the Camino and the 3 arroyo crossings that lead to our place, while not being overly gnarly, were best undertaken in a smaller lorry and not a 20-ton car transporter the size of a small block of apartments. He absorbed this detail readily, and we hit on a plan. He would enlist a local grower from Marbella to deliver the cars to him on stage 1 of their journey from our finca to Marbella, where they would be transferred to him for the trip up north on his big truck. The following Thursday morning was wet. The phone rang. It was another truck driver.
Christopher. Sí, soy yo. Buenos días. Soy Juanjo de la Grúa en Marbella para recoger los coches. ¿Usted dónde vive?
So I began to tell Juanjo, the Grúa driver, where I lived, so he could indeed pick up the cars. But Juanjo was more of a talker than a listener. I got him as far as the correct salida of the motorway, about 15 seconds of explanation, when he interrupted.
Escucha, los coches están cerca de Estepona.
No, you listen to me and I'll tell you exactly where they are, I said firmly, and resumed the explanation in succinct and intelligible Spanish. But Juanjo had a problem. His millennial attention span, the length of a 2-line WhatsApp, was already tapering.
Escucha,
he was saying again.
¿Por qué no me manda un ping, una ubicación en Google Map?
But I was unmoved.
No, we're doing this the old-fashioned way. Juanjo, get a pen and a paper and write down these simple instructions.
It was still raining 2 hours later when I met Juanjo at the rendezvous by the bridge where the tarmac ends and the Camino begins. I was in a splattered Nissan Patrol. He, sporting several shades of high-vis and an unnecessary pair of sunglasses, was sitting in the air-freshened Teflon-esque cab of a gleaming, spotlessly white flatbed truck. Marbella man, accustomed to scooping errantly behaved Bentleys and Mercs from gated community driveways, appeared genuinely unnerved by the prospect of floating his flatbed up 4 kilometres of mud, puddle and arroyo to retrieve 2 wrecks. But we'd had bigger trucks than his Grúa arrive at the finca. You just follow me, you'll be fine, I assured him. His boss, who he was calling now, obviously thought so too, and off we set, the patrol and the Grúa splashing up the track, the river in boisterous form just to our right. Juanjo drove agonizingly slowly, and I waited for him at the first of the three arroyos, some 10 meters wide, 18 inches deep, which I'd crossed to show him actually how doable it was. Eventually, he appeared in my rear view mirror, but like a horse refusing a jump, stopped, reversed into a gateway, and turned back to the bridge and the safety of the main road. Disappointed by this lack of anything remotely resembling the gung-ho spirit of a campesino, I pursued him the kilometre back to the bridge. It was hardly a pursuit. He was driving his now slightly soiled tray on wheels at walking pace whilst talking on his mobile. Oh well, if he wasn't going to take the cars, that's his problem, I thought. We'd already been paid for them after all. But at this point, my phone rang. It was Enrique, the camionero sent by Marisol of the Asturian scrapyard. He was in Marbella waiting for Juanjo to bring him our cars. Juanjo had already called him, complaining about the access. Of course there's access, I told Enrique. All Juanjo has to do is drive. We've had loads of trucks come to our place. The cars are there, ready for collection, if you want them. I had stuff to be getting on with. Time was slipping, as was my patience. But then Enrique did something unexpected. He preyed on my hitherto dormant sense of human kindness. Listen, I need your help, he said. If I don't get your vehicles back to the Asturias tomorrow night, I don't get paid. And to do that, I need to leave Marbella with them this afternoon. The thought of a lonely owner driver sitting parked in his cab in a strange town in the rain with the prospect of returning north unloaded, penniless and humiliated, or spending the weekend trying to find a grúa driver more competent than the spineless Juanjo, while La Señora Enrique was waiting for him with ebbing libido in her Friday night lingerie back up there in the Asturias. It was more than I could bear. Okay, I'll tow the cars to the bridge, I said, but I will need Juanjo's help. Claro, said Enrique. Juanjo, leave your camion here. You're coming with me, I told him. Once relieved of the responsibility of his grúa, and gradually more confident that the big dog brew breathing down his neck was in fact benign, Juanjo began to perk up in the front seat of the patrol and enjoy his day out. And as we drove up the devastated valley, Marbella man morphed into man with a mission, and to the extent that we were on the same mission, a sort of bonding occurred. We were a team. We hooked the Lexus to the patrol. He slithered into the filthy cabin and, with no power steering and limited brakes, gave a perfect performance in the art of being towed, which is, of course... Babes, are you listening? What is the art of... Oh, she's eating an energy bar. It's, of course, to keep the rope taut at all times, even on the sketchy descent we call the scary cliff. The Hilux next was more of a challenge for Juanjo in that it didn't have a seat, but like a squatting Fernando Alonso, he surfed it down the Camino to the waiting grúa on the handbrake. And in the act of bidding farewell to the Hilux and the Lexus, and indeed to the heroic Juanjo, it became more obvious than ever that we needed to buy some different cars. And I'll be telling you how we set about that next week.
At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Let's meet our first guest this morning. You may know of him already, author and indefatigable trail guide. He joins us now from the tiny pueblo of Carzola near Jaén. We say hello to Guy Hunter-Watts. Guy, are you there? Guy, are you there? Guy, can you hear me?
I can, indeed.
This is a nervous moment. The second week running. You're there. This is crack out the bubbly, babe. We've got Guy on the phone. That's absolutely brilliant. Guy, you still there?
I'm still here.
Amazing. Yep, right, okay. Listen, man, in a moment we're going to talk about the book Cicerone is Celebrating. Is it Cicerone or Cicerone, by the way?
We're having Cicerone. Cicerone. Oh. Ken was right.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I normally
All right, okay. She's wrestling with the light bulb at the moment. In a moment, yeah, we talk about Cicerone celebrating 50 years of adventure. This wonderful book that we've got on offer as a prize for a literary exploit that we'll be talking about in just a moment. But let's set the scene. You're in Cazorla right now, in northeast Andalusia. How is Cazorla today?
Cazorla, it's a spectacular day. Not a cloud in the sky, and I don't know if you've been up here, but it's just such a beautiful natural setting. You've got really steep limestone cliffs which just rise up all around the village, which is topped by its castle. It's one of my favourite villages in Andalusia, without doubt. Yeah,
and it's set in a national park, isn't it?
It's right at the gateway of the park.
Uh-huh.
So from Cazorla, a snaking road takes you up and into basically what's the early part of the Guadalquivir Valley. And that's where a lot of the walking and the trails are centred.
And what are you doing there, apart from sort of talking to us at the moment? You researching another trail? You're sort of working?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing, Kit. This time it's the GR7, which some people will have heard of. It's a long-distance walking path, which actually begins in Tarifa and ends in Athens. But my publisher...
Ends in where? Athens
in Greece, yeah. So,
how long does that take then?
Well, if you were to do the whole trail, I think you'd be walking for about 8 months. But in the case of my book, I'm just covering the section which runs across Andalusia, which is 1,300 kilometres, yeah.
So, and you're coming to the end of that now, you've walked...
Yeah, very much so. I've got about 1,120 covered, leaving me about another 200 k's to go.
Good. And you're engaged in that this weekend, are you?
Yeah, that's right. I've been up here for about 3 days now, and today I'll be doing a section which leads actually right along the Guadalquivir Valley, which is very beautiful.
Short of water? Short of water up there?
The water situation up here, all of the springs I've been walking past are really good. It's looking fine. But normally, at this time of year, you could have snow. I've been in the Cazorla Park and actually been unable to get out when the snow has come quite suddenly. It's another one of these sierras, like the Sierra Nevada,
mm-hmm.
where if you're up here in winter, you really should have your chains in the car, which, of course, I forgot to bring with me. But luckily, so far, so good.
Because mountains can catch you out. We'll talk more about mountains in a moment. But I want to mention now this gorgeous book that celebrates 50 years of survival experiences, Journeys of Self-Discovery from... it says in the forward, from the Thames Valley. I couldn't actually find one in the Thames Valley, but certainly from somewhere as mild as that to the very summit of K2. Trekking, climbing, running, cycling. And the key is in the name of the publisher, which we now know is pronounced Cicerone, which means actually what?
Well, Cicerone, actually, there was a Roman geezer by the name of Cicero, and he was known for his fine skills in oratory, and he was a very erudite man. And so in Roman times, you know, to be Cicero-like meant that you were pretty good on your subject. And later, it kind of became a synonym for being a guide, originally more in the sense of the museum art gallery context. And later, it kind of spread. So a Cicerone is basically somebody who gives you good guiding advice,
Cicerone in the way of being a guide rather than being an indomitable walker. But today, of course, Cicerone means something else, doesn't it, particularly here in Spain?
Is that right?
It means you have 20 guides operating and a website. And you're one of them.
I was lucky when my previous publisher Santana Books, who some people will remember. Many people would have had their tapas, cooking, You and the Law in Spain books, etc. Santana ceased to trade about 5 years ago, so I sent off my title to Cicerone. And yeah, I'm lucky. I've got four books in their stable now and just writing this fifth one. So.
And there are other guides, aren't there? So, for example, if you wanted to walk the Picos de Europa and really didn't know your way around, you could connect with Cicerone via a website, yes, and find a guide. Is that a service Cicerone offer?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Cicerone.co.uk, you'll see the full range of books on Spain and, of course, on places like Switzerland. One of the very earliest Cicerone publications, in fact, by the legendary writer of Cicerone, Kev Reynolds, was to the Spanish Pyrenees, which is where he kind of cut his walking teeth. And Kev later went on to write lots and lots of books for Cicerone about the Swiss, the French Alps, the Italian Alps, etc. And then once they kind of got a reputation for being the best guide people in Europe and the UK, of course, they then sort of spread further afield and started writing guides to, you know, Everest, Himalaya, you name it.
Yes, because they cut their teeth in fairly unambitious style, didn't they, back in Blighty. It all began in an unlikely cooperative venture between a Yorkshireman and a Lancastrian, I believe, back in 1969, because celebrating your 50th anniversary. I mean, a Yorkshireman and a Lancastrian are not the most obvious of bedfellows, but tell us how that came about. How was that born?
Well, basically, they were two young men with a passion for climbing. And one of them was involved in publishing. The other one was a teacher. So they had, in a way, quite good credentials to start producing books. And they came together with the idea originally of the very first guide was about the Pennine Way, and which has recently been created. And what happened with Cicerone was they kind of very much synced in with the zeitgeist at the time. All of a sudden, walking was becoming a very popular thing to do. People were taking to the mountains and to footpaths in droves, which is kind of all related to the kind of, you know, end of the age of discovery, if you like, the conquest of Everest in the 50s. All of a sudden, people are seeing the mountains as places for, you know, contemplation, for adventure.
Good. That's interesting, that, isn't it? Because the Victorians hated the mountains.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. They were like the most uncouth, uncivilized. Well, why on earth would you want to go there? So there was a sea change in people's relationship to mountains.
I think it's all to do with the gear. The outfits.
Yeah.
I do. I know it sounds funny, but I do. I mean, now you can keep warm as opposed to get exposure. Sort of. I mean, what gear do you wear, Guy?
Well, I mean, funnily enough, I'm a bit of the old school. I kind of have my old leather boots, and I have recently discovered the joys of these down-filled fleeces, which pack down so small, you might as well have one in the bottom of your rucksack. But generally speaking, I'd say my sartorial style on the mountains isn't very up-to-date.
Okay. Answer me this. Do you shop at Decathlon?
I certainly do, Kit. Yeah. I've got my Decathlon waterproof gear, and not so much for boots. Have you heard of Brescia boots, the classic English walking boots?
No, Brescia?
Brescia, yeah. Chris Brescia is a bit of a legend in the walking world. When Roger Bannister ran his four-minute mile, one of the people pacing him was Chris Brescia, who was a brilliant runner himself, but not quite as good as Roger Bannister, yeah. So, and Chris Brescia brought his love of sport, if you like, to the world in the form of, starting to produce outdoor walking gear. And virtually everybody in the UK, in the same way that you'd have your Rowan jackets and trousers, which kind of zip apart, you know, those weird-looking things.
I think you're a bit of a snob there, Guy. You just can't bear to... I bet you haven't got a zip on your knees there to whip them into shorts.
Yeah, well, Guy is a professional. I mean, he can afford to spend the time considering his outfit. And, his denouement on the mountain. I know, and professional walkers, or people who walk a lot, do that. I can remember being horrendously unequipped for a walk we did, a three-day walk in the Rif Mountains of Morocco, when my brother turned up, who we'll be interviewing in a moment, actually, turned up in a full North Face sort of Gore-Tex, Kevlar, blah, blah, blah.
You had a rubbish bag.
And I had nothing. I had a jumper, and it rained, and I was actually forced to go down into Arroyo, fish out a piece of old polythene, cut a hole in the top of it, and fashion myself a poncho. So anyway, that's about my lack of preparation. Let's go back to the book, though. This wonderful book, which I'm holding a copy of now. It's really a synopsis of routes worldwide, and it strikes me, if I was to be a little bit critical, that there could have been more deserts, more forests, more coastlines, more river valleys, but it's mountains that dominate the landscape here. I mean, there's Mount Whitney, Mount Blanc, Kosciuszko, Kilimanjaro, Kailash, K2. Why so many mountains, Guy? I mean, what is it about? Even your chapter in here is about Tordesillas, here in the Sierra de las Nieves, another mountain. What is it about mountains that fire people up?
it's a strange thing, isn't it? This desire of just always wanting to get to the top of things. I think maybe certainly I'd say it's a cultural thing. It's about conquest. It's about personal achievement. It's maybe about pushing yourself that little bit further than, say, if you're just walking round a mountain. And there is something which is always true. If you get to the top of the mountain and the weather's right, you've just got the best view that you're going to get.
It's a kind of obvious objective as well, isn't it? You can see it from wherever, assuming that it's not shrouded in mist and cloud. You can see the peak, and you're going up there.
So, within
this book, it is mountains that dominate, but there's also some softer trails. There's a very nice trail, an Italian trail on a pilgrimage route. I'm looking for it now. I can't actually find it.
That's right, Kit. I mean, there are less demanding walks. There are also walks which cycling, climbing. I must admit, I haven't had the chance.
Have you not read the book?
Well, hey, I haven't read all of the book. I read my section on it.
Of course you did. Yes, of course. Of which I have to say, there's a kind of funny bit at the end about sections that have things that have not necessarily gone to plan.
Oh, yeah.
Getting
yeah,
caught in an
yeah.
avalanche or whatever. And you've written one about taking some Germans out on a walk, I believe.
That was just a weird one. When I was actually taking Claire Balding on a walk for her radio program on Radio 4, which is called Rambles.
Ramblings.
And I saw these Germans with a copy of my book, and we kind of walked up to them, and sort of Claire said, "Good morning," in a very chirpy style. And,
good morning.
And she said, and they had my book, and she said, "Oh, well, meet the author." And they looked at me almost in disgust, and they said, "There is no way marking on the trails, and you walk too fast." And they just walked off.
That's splendid.
Yeah.
Did she think that was funny?
Yeah, oh, God, we had such a laugh. And actually, about half an hour after that, it absolutely started chucking it down with rain.
Yeah.
And that was an example of a day when I was totally ill-prepared. Waterproof.
Right.
Yeah. So we all got drenched. But being a BBC crew, they were about, you know, an hour late turning up, and then they had a coffee, then another coffee. And meanwhile, the clouds were rolling in, and so anyway, that's another story.
But you can read that story in the last part of Cicerone's Celebrating 50 Years of Adventures, 1969 to 2019. It's called Close Encounter of the Dynamic Germanic kind. And so, to our competition, we have one of these fabulous books to give away, which your publishers have very kindly donated, Guy, to the programme. Yeah. So thanks, thanks to them. Thanks very much to them. And we're going to set you a little task for an account of no more than 200 words of an excursion that you have made on foot that captured your imagination and memory, that turned into some sort of an adventure in any landscape, even an urban one. You mentioned IKEA, didn't you, Ben?
A trip to IKEA. Yes, it doesn't have to be a mountain.
Pushing the envelope slightly.
Well, I've never done it before.
But that it was in some way remarkable. You might have been climbing a mountain. You might have been walking a river. You might have been taking the dog for a walk. Your adventure might have involved an escape from danger, the beginning or end of a romance, an epiphany moment of realisation, getting hopelessly lost in a strange town or in a complex of caves, in which case I'm glad you're listening here today. It might have ended in a spellbinding sunset. It could be anywhere in the world or in space, if you're an astronaut, at any time of your life. And the contact, my darling, is...
hogs@tre.com.
hogs@tre.com is the address for your submission. Guy, it's been wonderful having you on the programme. We're going to sit back and wait for these wonderful literary gems to roll
in.
Sorry,
tre.radio, I apologise.
Say that again, Ben.
hogs@tre.radio.
Kit Hog and Penny.
At home.
With the Hogs.
And welcome back to the second hour of Talk Radio Europe's magazine show. Let's have some music. Here's Dustin Tebbutt with a song called Bones.
Find you on a steep blisters, you hold you could find you
our programs do the talking.
At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
We plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the land.
Yes, it's that time of day when we talk about things that grow out of the ground. Welcome to another episode of Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens. But today, with characteristic unpredictability, something else. Palms, trees, gardens and pools. An aquatic zone where Arbalista is a relative stranger, a feature common in many Costa gardens, the swimming pool. Now, next time you see something resembling a bear in the suburbs or a burly rock star persona in your garden standing next to your swimming pool with one of those long poles with a net on the end, don't call the police. It may very well be JJ Dedena, the pool doctor, who joins us now. JJ, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
And I gather you're speaking to us from sunny Rwanda today.
Oh, it's gorgeous down here. What? The sun is out, it's a lot of people. A bit of the old bitch of the Romans. It's beautiful.
So a bit of a day out, a bit of a morning out.
Well, I got a visitor from Belgium over, so I thought, well, quickly pop into Rwanda and then, show him something. First time he's been out, so.
Oh, good. And I gather you're surrounded by cyclists at the moment.
Oh, you call them that, do we? There is, everything is blocked off and everything is chaos because there's a mammal race. Which is...
Tell us.
For the people who do not know what a mammal is, we call them middle-aged men in lycras. So they're like sweating and running up hills in the sun and, well, I don't see the point really.
JJ.
Well, I think
anyway.
You'd look great in lycra, Jay. I can see it now.
Not really.
Oh, that would be shocking. Yes. I'm imagining
all
it.
In one, yeah.
Now, JJ, let's talk about pools in the course of an average week. How many pools do you visit?
5 times 5, 25.
Okay.
25?
And you were telling me the other day that there are no two pools are the same. How exciting is that, or are you going mad?
Listen, to be honest, you know where we live. We're neighbours. I do pools every day, and I prefer swimming in our little river. Every pool is basically a pain in the backside. They all have their own quirks. They all have their own things. No two pools are alike. It's always something. So you get to build up a relationship with a pool, and then you can find that very difficult balance of keeping it clear and keeping it, well, not toxicated, because I see people with pools that I would not swim in. I would prefer not to swim in a chemical bath.
But JJ, isn't that a reflection on you, the pool medic? You should
not really.
Shouldn't you? Isn't your job to make a pool immediately appetizing and a safe and healthy place in which to swim?
Yes, this is what we try to do. We try to do it the correct way, but we still use chlorine, and chlorine is a bad product. And without that, you can forget it. You will be swimming in soup in 4 hours. So. It's, but then again, every villa, every house, every tourist destination, if there is no swimming pool, they won't book. They want a swimming pool. And it's a pain in the backside, especially in the summer.
So to go back to the chlorine thing, is there really no alternative?
I thought you could have salt pools now.
Say this again, pardon?
I thought you could have salt pools now.
Yes, they're a pain in the backside as well, because it takes a while to fill them up. You know, you have to drive to the coast, scoop water out of the sea, fill the
no, you don't.
No, you don't.
Put it back in buckets, yeah.
Well, it all depends on a lot of things. The majority of problems that we have to solve on a weekly basis in summer is obviously it turning green, it turning algae, it turning into soup.
So, JJ, none of the 25 pools you look after are salt. They're all
good. They're all good, but they all have their own quirk, so you have to build up a relationship. So doing a new pool is getting to learn and getting to know the pool.
Yes.
How do I treat this baby well so I can just balance between not green, green, not green, without over-intoxicating people?
But my question is that all your pools, are they all chlorine? All the 25 pools you look after, you put chlorine in? Or are there other ways? Right, so they're all chlorine.
Okay. Well, no. The people that can afford it, they use a better product called bromide, which is four times more expensive. Like, say, for instance, we look after a jacuzzi and we look after an indoor swimming pool. If you put chlorine in an indoor swimming pool and you put bubbles in the jacuzzi, the toxic fumes that come off this could burn your lungs. The moment you smell chlorine, it has done damage. That's what you need to know. So chlorine is bad stuff.
Mm.
Remember, I was an offshore diver in my former life, so I know a bit about lungs and I know all that stuff. Your lung alveoli, your little bladders in your lungs will just... The moment you smell it, it does damage. It burns them.
How are you maintaining pools now in the winter? Are people using their pools, or generally are they shut down? Or is there a sort of dormant phase for swimming pools where they require less maintenance?
Yes, the pools that are being used now are all by Finland people. They're polar bears, because it's freezing cold.
Okay, the Finns swim still.
Heating up a pool, as I said, we do a few pools that are heated. It costs these people between 400 and 800 euros a month just to have this pool on 27 or 25 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's very expensive.
It's a huge pool.
Not really. Not really. They're not huge. But energy and electricity is very expensive in Spain. Mm. But then there's people that say, okay, we don't use it, we don't do anything to it. We don't winterize it, we shut everything off and we put one block of chlorine every 3 weeks. Which, well, not enough, because then the pump seizes up, then the roots grow through pipes, the skimmer pipe breaks off, there's air bubbles in the system. It all depends what kind of pool and where it is situated, because even a pool, the same similar pool next door, which gets the sun earlier, it changes everything.
So when a pool turns green, you've referred to a couple of times, what's happening then?
Well, 90% of the time it's in summer. The biggest enemy of a swimming pool is sunscreen oil. If you really want to, if you hate somebody and you go to the swimming pool, you open the skimmer and you squirt a bottle of sunscreen oil in that, that pool will never be right again.
Okay.
That takes months and months and months. They'll have to change the sun in the filter. Everything gets clogged up. And it goes green in, hours.
It's really complicated stuff, isn't it? I mean, we don't have a pool, but the majority of places in the Costa del Sol, the majority of gardens
where
in the Costa
the
del Sol all have pools. Does anyone actually use a swimming pool? I've never seen anyone in the swimming. When you turn
if
up,
they see you not coming, they're going to scoff. Yeah,
JJ, you go to 25 pools a week, man. Is anyone ever in them?
In summer there is.
Apart from,
but as you know, what we do a full package, me and a colleague, which means we do build gardens, we maintain the garden, which means we also get shitloads of clients that say, okay, I have a pool, but I have no time for it. Because they all think it's very easy, you just hoover it with the pool and you're the pool boy and that. No, it's finding that balance of your own pool. Doing the skimmer half up and a little bit on the fondo, finding that balance, not to over-chlorinate the pool. Stuff like that, it's a balance and people just get bored with it.
Mm. But certainly outside of the summer months, it's quite rare to find someone in a pool. I remember turning up to do an estimate at a villa in Soto Grande, and a woman about my age in a swimsuit turning up, sort of quite goose pimpled. She'd be in a swimsuit. She'd just come out of the swimming pool to answer the door, and I thought, good on you. You're actually swimming. You're actually using your pool, enjoying the therapy of cold water.
Yeah, well, she must be Finnish, man. It's the polar bear
situation. No, she was from England. She was from Cirencester.
I hear you, but there's either something wrong with that person, because it's freezing cold. And when I say cold, it's freezing cold, man.
It's not freezing cold.
As you know, I don't like cold.
No, I
know. Yeah, but still, I hate cold. Think shrink when you're... No, I'm not going in cold pools, man. You're the one that goes in cold river. I don't even do that. I swim in the river in the summer.
I think the most beautiful pool I've ever seen was when we were all in Portugal last summer,
mm-hmm.
and there was a swimming pool at the wedding venue, and that was cleaned by a reed bed system.
Yes.
And it was just a very light green. There was no chemicals in it, and there was a little
frog. Whoa. I was at that same party, remember? Yes,
yeah.
There is still chemicals in it, but he tries to refilter it in an ecological way, which is great, but
Were there really chemicals in it, JJ? Because they had little fish and frogs in there.
I hear you.
And it didn't smell.
I hear you. So you reduce the chlorine and reduce the bromide use by using natural filters like the roots of the plants. But I tell you this, that's a private villa. He rents that out for one weekend to people who go in with sunscreen. That turns into soup overnight. done. And them roots of them plants will never be able to do it. So it's all great if you have like a swimming pond. Then it's fine. Commercially, forget it.
Okay.
There's no way you can keep that clean.
I don't know about this bromide, though, JJ. Isn't that what they put in tea in jail to stop you thinking about sex?
Say this again.
Bromide.
This could be lost in translation.
Is it? That's something they put in tea in prisons so that to sort of calm people down, reduce testosterone.
Well, bromide does it in a way the same as... No, it's a different product, probably.
Okay.
But bromide is the same as chlorine, but it's so much more refined. The fumes are less aggressive. But it's way, way, way more expensive. So indoor pools, you kind of have to, otherwise you're killing people. But hey, I've seen... Well, let's call them colleagues, yeah? When we take over the villa and there's a pool and it goes green and the gardener comes and he... How would you say in English, aguaras?
Aguaras?
Yeah, what's aguaras?
Is it agua fuerte? Is
agua fuerte. So he comes there and
well,
he just
English,
opens five bottles of 5 liters and pours this in the pool. That's paint stripper. Yes, it turns clear, but you go in, you strip your skin off. You come out with purple and green hair. I've seen people return a pool which was completely green with like, so what are they, cobra? There's people throwing stuff in pools. Be careful, it's a chemical soup. A pool is a balance, and doing it the right way is a bit of an art to every pool on its own. And I'm very lucky I had a fantastic care, and I still have, a master of pools, because you call me the pool doctor. I call myself a pool nurse. I'm not that vain, but finding that balance is the big, big, big thing.
Okay.
Now, the nicest thing is, what would you do if you build a new pool? Would you build a saltwater one? Would you build a this one? Would you build like an ecological one? It all depends on what you want to do with your pool and your villa. Again, if you have an ecological pool, like pond, swimming pond, filtered by roots, by the plants, forget it. You will never have a commercial situation because you will be a slave of your pool every day to find that balance.
Slave of the pool. JJ, on that note, we're going to have to leave you, man. It's been illuminating. We do thank you for your time.
And are you a pool boy?
Well, I can be.
What
I'm thinking now about the light
right now. You get a pool boy.
Pool boy.
Okay. I clean pools. Yes, I've made it.
Keep drinking the bromide, man. Thanks, man. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's JJ Dedena talking to us on swimming pools from sunny Rhondda. Now, it's that time of year when pines are laden with little white tent-shaped nests that could, at a stretch, be quite picturesque were it not for the withering effect that the processionary caterpillar has on its host tree. Denuded foliage, bare tips and dieback. And for the potentially fatal to dogs effect of the oruga. Babes, you've got something on
yes,
how,
I mean, every
how the processionary caterpillar might affect your dog.
I think everybody is familiar with the processionary caterpillar, and we were talking to Guy just now, and we didn't have time, but he did mention that it's pretty prevalent where he is. It's not unusual, but that, I think with climate change, there are a lot more of them. So there is the big, fat, cotton wool looking nests in pine trees. So what you need to be careful of, if you have a dog or kids, yes, darling, what were you going
to
say?
Well, I just, sorry to interrupt you, but we've got Hans on the line, and I'm just going to take the call. Hi, Hans, good morning to you.
Morning. Look, your friend you just said on calls himself pool doctor. Well, I do disagree at least with 50% of what he said.
Ah, okay.
And I do 50 pools, and I work since 15 years in one of the biggest pool shops here in the northern Costa Blanca.
Yes.
And I have 15 saltwater pools, and they do all brilliant, so I just can recommend it to them.
Excellent.
It's a high venom stuff, which we basically only use in jacuzzis. You can use oxygen, you can use ultraviolet lamps to reduce the chlorine level. That's many things you didn't say so.
Ultraviolet lights,
specialized, but they want to know a bit more information than just believing in what JJ just said.
So a pool need not necessarily be a chemical soup?
No, it doesn't need to be. you need between 1.5. Well, I do also have about 10 or 12 pools which are rented out in summer, and JJ is right. They're more difficult. Sun cream is really bad. But therefore, you work with a lot of flocculant, which holds the sun cream back in the filter, do good backwashes. And when he said people throwing agua forte in there, well, you have to put acid in there to get the pH right, because the pH is getting high, and then the chlorine is not working nicely, and that's why pool. There's always some, same client said to me, oh, put the stuff in. I saw the neighbor did it, or the neighbor's pool boy, and then it got, the green got off. I said, yeah, probably the pH was too high, so he had to bring it down with the acid, and then the chlorine, whatever you have got in there, the oxygen, works fine. So there's other alternatives, and I can highly recommend saltwater systems. There is some on the market now which works with only 2.5 gram salt per liter, so you don't even notice the salt in there. I have got one at home myself. With
you have. You've got
grams.
You've got your own swimming pool, yeah?
Yes.
Right. Hans, thanks very much for
thank
that,
you,
man.
Hans,
a pool doctor who's reassuring us that a pool need not necessarily be a chemical soup. We've got Alan from Los Almagros on.
Hello, guys. Lovely show. I also have to disagree with the pool doctor. What Hans said, a lot of what Hans said was good as well. The guy before, he was talking about, well, a lot of what he was saying wasn't correct. My swimming pool back in England used to have 107,027 gallons of water. I used to work in a commercial swimming pool. If you can smell chlorine in a pool, an indoor pool, it's a thing called nitrogen trichloride, and it's a mixture of urine and not enough chlorine.
Smell chlorine, it is
urine. Pool. You know when you go into a swimming pool sometimes and you can smell it?
Yes.
But that's a lack of chlorine in the pool. It's a build-up of chloramines, which is chlorine that is already active with urine.
Okay. Well, that's
so if you
that's
can smell a pool,
yep.
If you smell a pool, you need to test it, but you need to you test the three chlorines, and then you test for your combined chlorines, which I don't think is done over here on normal pools. But as I say, I used to get 107,027 gallons. I couldn't get that wrong. You know what I mean?
Okay, so if a pool smells of chlorine, i.e. there's urine in it, what do you put in then?
You get out quick for starch.
It won't do you a lot of harm, but the nitrogen trichloride is a gas that floats 6 inches above the water. That's why your eyes actually sting. There are a few people that will actually take a little bit of chlorine through osmosis through the eyes. Mm. Again, if you go to a swimming pool and it's a new pool, you might come out with a thing that you call chlorine itch. So you can use anti-chlorine shampoos and stuff like that. But I'd certainly look it up. If you just type into the internet, chlorine smells, and it will tell you all about it.
Okay. Well, that is really interesting. And I absolutely agree.
Right. Alan,
if you take a test and you don't think there is any chlorine in the pool, do what they call a half test. So if you take your 10 mL sample and it goes white, then reduce it to 5 mils of pool water, 5 mils of tap water, do another test. Sometimes if you test the pool and there's too much chlorine in it, the tablets can bleach out and you think there's not enough, so you then go and add more, which is more dangerous.
Right.
One of the girls, she told me she didn't have any chlorine in the pool. I went over to one of my other pools, and she actually did 10 milligrams per 100, whatever it was in the day. So the pool was overchlorinated, and if people had a swim in that at a level of 10, it would have bleached. It would have bleached their costumes out.
Okay. Alan, thank you for that.
Okay, mate. Great show. Thank you as well.
It's very nice. Alan. Very nice to have you on. Thanks, man. Yeah. Thank you for that. Right, from one toxicity to another. Yes, I'm really glad we don't have a pool. The more we talk about it, really. We've got time to go back to orugas, which are processionary caterpillars. Darling, before we got diverted there again, back into pools.
You
were talking about the effect of an oruga on a dog, a processionary caterpillar.
It can be actually lethal. Like you were working on some pines last week, and we have a dog ourselves two dogs, and I just said, no way do you take the dog with you today. Because
that was the motive for doing the work, actually. The client had a dog and was terrified that his small pine forest was crawling with processionary caterpillars.
Yes, absolutely. But I've got a little readout here quickly. The caterpillar causes various injuries to dogs. The symptoms are similar to those of an allergic reaction. The tongue, esophagus and stomach swell up. And eventually the dog can't breathe and dies. And in most cases, this doesn't happen because they get to a vet in time. But the animal's tongue, where it has touched a caterpillar, suffers necrosis and they can lose their tongue. So we're not being dramatic. It's actually true. If your dog has been in contact with caterpillars, just get them to a vet because it can be lethal.
Mm. Because as February approaches now, along with the weather, the processionary caterpillar is warming up. It leaves its nest by day to gorge on pine needles before returning for a night's of bloated slumber. And one day in the not too distant future, in an exemplary demonstration of teamwork, they join nose to tail. Now, I'm always wondering at this time of year how they decide which caterpillar will go first.
Oh, they probably don't. They're insects, I mean, they're not going to make decisions. They
think happens. They have a sort of conference.
No,
or a vote or something. But because you must feel incredibly exposed, this front runner caterpillar, because all the others are joined nose to tail.
Maybe that's why they go in circles.
They don't go in circles. If they went in circles, they wouldn't go anywhere.
Exactly. They do that, actually.
What?
They will join into circles? A circle and just go round and round.
I've never seen that. Okay.
No, I've actually very rarely seen them myself. But, yeah.
Anyway, so they will leave the tree, nose to tail, one day soon. And it really depends on the weather. If it carries on bright and sunny without any rain, we'll see them quite soon. And they leave the tree. They crawl down the stem. You probably know this, particularly if you've got pines, in search of a sanctuary in which to hibernate in chrysalis pupas underground during the summer, from which they hatch in around August as reproductive adults who fly back up into the pines to lay their eggs, from which hatch the aruga, and the whole dismal cycle starts again. The unfortunate processionary caterpillar. I mean, what is the point of a processionary caterpillar? Why does it exist?
I don't know, and it was probably quite happily sitting in its evolutionary slot where it was meant to be, but they've just got out of control.
When you make these observations, you're talking normally about a response to an imbalance.
Yes.
I mean, like the palm beetle, a processionary caterpillar seems to enjoy the life of O'Reilly. It chomps away all day, not even remotely threatened by anything that chomps on it. Or does it?
Well, the caterpillar eggs are eaten by crickets.
Ah, are they?
Yeah, by crickets eat them. The larvae... birds eat them. The great tit, the cuckoo, all eat the larva. Now, wasps, solitary wasps, that is, eat the larva, as do some horsefly. Another bird which particularly likes the larva is the hoopoe. That you don't see. I would love to see a hoopoe. I've seen one once, but my sister Jane.
This one there, babe. She's on the window.
Fancy that. How did you do that?
Well, with the heifer entranced by the hoopoe outside the window, we're going to take a break now. We'll be back with Gavin Hogg, who's going to take us to Lomantang.
At home with the Hogs. With the Hogs. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Thank you.
our theme of mountains today, our next guest is about to expound on an adventure in the greatest range on Earth, the mighty Himalayas, recently returned from a 10-day trek to and from the land of Lomantang. It's my very own brother, Gavin. He joins us appropriately at Home with the Hogs. Gav, hi, how are you doing?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You're slightly muffled, but we'll battle on. I'm sure the line will clear. Now, lots of us have actually trekked in Nepal, but the trail you did to this place called Lomantang has opened only recently, relatively recently. Just tell us where it is, actually.
Well, it's in the Annapurna Conservation Range. And it's a state, a small state called Mustang. And Mustang is a tiny area of land that interjects into Tibet. As if you look at the northern border of Nepal, it bumbles along and then suddenly you get this pimple that sticks out into Tibet. And that's Mustang. So it's surrounded on three sides by Tibet. And in the middle is this ancient kingdom of the kingdom of Lo, and there is this ancient, the word city is probably too grand for it because it's not a big settlement, but it is a city, the city of Lomantang.
And is it ostensibly Tibetan? Is it ethnically and culturally Tibetan?
It is. The people are essentially Tibetan. They live as Nepalese under the political sanctuary of Nepal. But China surrounds them, and you have to get a special license to go into Mustang that is controlled. Our guides were saying that you buy the license to go to the country, into Mustang, and then you report out. And if you don't report out, then A, they're wondering if you're dead on the mountain, or B, whether or not you've gone into Tibet to spy on the Chinese. They're pretty paranoid up there.
Okay, so you had to fulfill that, those strictures, in order to be able to go to Mustang, yeah?
Yeah, and it costs a fair bit of money to get the registration.
Oh, okay.
It only opened in 1999, for tourism, and then it was the area was sort of prone to sort of Maoist attacks and kidnapping, so there was a degree of instability there, and it's only there was the sort of the coup in Nepal in 2008 when the royalty were deposed, and at that point the king of Lo along with the king of Nepal no longer held any sovereign powers, and Nepal became a republic, and similarly the same sort of thing happened in Mustang at that time.
So Lomantang no longer has a king? It is no longer a kingdom, or is it a republic? Or
similar to the UK, really, there is a king, but and I met the king's brother, actually. It is purely now by name and title, and there are no powers bestowed.
Sure, sure. A titular constitutional monarchy. Now, you didn't do this walk alone, did you? And because we have to say that you did arrive in Lomantang on foot. It was part of an expedition. How did that come together? Who did you do it with?
Well, it started at a dinner party with some friends who needed an extra person to make the group viable. And ever since I was a child, I remember flicking through a National Geographic magazine at school and coming across pictures of this area and Tibetan Nepali people, and always been fascinated. And I've still got that picture in my belongings somewhere. And Polly, a dear friend, was saying, you know, why don't you come? And so I got permission from the wife, and I joined the group. There was a group of six of us that then became seven. I only knew two members of the group, and the other five were friends of theirs. And then we had two Nepali guides and one pony man from Mustang. We put our bags onto ponies, and we did the 150-mile walk from Johnson up to Lomantang, following the Kalikandagi Valley.
So just going back to the group, this is quite interesting, the dynamic. I mean, you had to make a commitment to, apart from one or two people in a group you didn't necessarily know too well, and I suppose that was all part of the challenge. I mean, there's nothing quite like travelling with a person to get to know them, warts and all, is there?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was interesting, to walk with people you didn't know and get to know them. And it became apparent to me that you also then had a personal responsibility to keep your act together. And if the guide said we're leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning, then it was your responsibility to get yourself together for 6 o'clock in the morning, get your breakfast in, get water, prepare yourself for that trek. And then we operated as a group.
Yes.
And it became, there were members of the group who started struggling and falling behind, and suddenly what became a kind of 9-hour walk some days would be a 13-hour walk, and you'd finish it in darkness, and then the kind of other dangers or threats would become apparent.
How hard was it physically?
Well, the main element was the altitude. We walked through the Himalayas. We walked through the actual range, and then we entered into the High Asian Plateau, which is basically a desert.
Mm-hmm.
Very dry, but we were walking on average at about 3,900 meters. So you're sucking oxygen. And you're fine on the flat, you're fine going downhill, but the moment you start climbing up to a pass, you are, you're sucking air and drinking loads of water.
Are you? Yes, yes. Did it get easier as the days went on?
Yeah, and that was beautiful, feeling your body adjust and...
Even though you were gaining height, presumably, it got you became accustomed to...
Your body acclimatizes incredibly quickly.
Uh-huh.
When you're breathing that hard, and the first effect is a headache. But if you stop and drink, then the headache normally goes very quickly.
Okay. I
mean, we're all different.
And if you stop and drink.
Trail, okay. I met people on the trail who had to be helicoptered off, or back in Pokhara. When we got back to Pokhara, I met people who had been helicoptered off because they couldn't, physically, handle it. And if you look at, there was that program recently, wasn't there, with the two television celebrities who climbed Everest.
No idea.
Victoria Pendleton, who was an Olympic athlete, pentathlete. And the guy who does everything, who was on Taran, say, Ben, the golden boy, anyway.
Don't know.
He got to the top of Everest, and he was not an athlete, whereas she couldn't do it, and she had to be helicoptered off.
Okay, so it's a bit like seasickness, possibly.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a reflection of personal fitness. Now, I just want to go. So the walk was how many days?
We walked for 11 days. We walked for 10 days. We had a day off in the middle in Lomantang, but we did actually walk up towards the Tibetan border and visit some temples up there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And to actually get to the trailhead, you flew to Kathmandu, and then you caught a plane to you went from Kathmandu to Pokhara,
And then you caught a plane from Pokhara to Jomsom, the place where you began your actual walk. I gather that flight was unusual.
Yeah, it was probably the most radical flight I've done. It was a little two-engine aeroplane sat 16 people. And it starts flying early in the morning, about 5:30 in the morning, and they do as many shuttles as they can before the winds get up, which normally happen about 10:30, 11 o'clock. And then
So the wise time to fly is to get up in the morning and go out early.
Yeah, the earlier your flight, the better, because it's more calm.
Yes.
And you weave your way through these massive mountains, and you can see the pilots and through the windscreen at the front. And at one point, I looked up, and you just saw this white wall of ice in front of the aeroplane. And then you look out the window to your side, and the wing tip is just touching the side of the mountain with a few scrubby juniper trees. And it was very exciting.
Exciting. Right, and that flight is about how long?
Well, it's about 30 minutes, 40 minutes.
Oh, okay.
It's a 4-day trek that I believe you did way back in the '70s. When you were there, I think you said it was 4 days.
No, not to Jomsom. No, I didn't go to Jomsom. But Mustang, as you were talking about the security situation in Mustang was a definite no-go area. You couldn't go there because there were Tibetan guerrillas fighting the Chinese that were CIA-backed, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, having got to Jomsom, Tell us about the first day of your walk. I mean, that must have been the sense of anticipation of actually getting out on the trail. How was it on that first day? You were all booted up and off you went.
Yes, it sort of all happened very quickly. We sort of got out of the aeroplane, and then we had to do a bit of paperwork and registration with a local police force there. And then suddenly we were off, and it was...
Oh, on that actual day, on the day of the flight?
The day of the flight, we went to Jomsom. Our first, we walked, I think, about 15 miles the first day to a small town called Kagbeni, which is like at the trailhead. Kagbeni is a hub, and you can either spin off and go to Muktinar and do Annapurna Base Camp, which runs to the east, or there's another trail that goes sort of to the west, I think it's called Dolpuro, or you go north to Mustang and Lomantang. So Kagbeni was quite a funky little town in the mountains. It was about the last place you could get a decent cup of coffee, and it was a fun place to hang out in. But yeah, it was a bit, I don't know if you've ever been skiing, but skiing is, you get up in the morning and you've got to make sure you've got everything together, you know, your rucksack and your ski pass and your everything's in the right place at the right time and your camera's available, and suddenly it was a bit like that. You had to suddenly get organised.
Yes, from what sort of situation in terms of overnight stops? Was this hostel or where were you staying?
We were staying in little tea houses along the trail in these tiny little settlements. You know, as tourism has been there for 10 years or so, local people are seeing the opportunities of tourism and opening little tea houses. We ate really well. They've all got little gardens and they grow vegetables, and we ate sort of vegetables and rice most meals.
Lots of lentils, was it?
Sorry?
Lots of lentils, did you eat?
Rice and pasta with fresh vegetables.
Oh, pasta, really? Okay, all right.
Yeah, which they call chow mein.
Yeah.
Instead of noodles, it's pasta.
Okay. And so tell us a little bit. You were walking up a valley with mountains either side. How did the land strike you in terms of its ecology, in terms of the state of the planet, Did the land feel vibrant, or was it on the bones of its ass?
The landscape is immense. It's vast, and the clarity of air is so pure and beautiful. And we were there. There are seasons where you go. You either go in spring or in late October.
To avoid a monsoon, yeah.
Yeah, to avoid clouds, low clouds. So we had beautiful weather, clear blue skies every day. During the day, it would be about 14 degrees, and then as the sun went down, it would drop to -5, -8
mm-hmm.
at night.
Mm-hmm.
Cold in the morning getting up, cold at night sleeping. But the landscape is extraordinary. It is, at one point in time, it was underneath the ocean. And the Himalayas are constructed out of conglomerate rocks. And some of them are quite small. And when India collided with Asia and this uplift with plate tectonics,
mm-hmm.
with the Himalayas out of the ocean, so the rock is a conglomerate, like a sandy seashore, and the wind and the ice create these incredible erosion patterns on the sides of the mountains. It's incredibly sculptural. It was described by a Frenchman as being as barren as a dead deer, but it has immense, stark beauty, and the people there are happy, they're very spiritual, and it just felt, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
As barren as a dead deer, did you say?
Yes, I read that quote this morning.
Oh, okay.
I've been reading.
Right, yes, because you're reading a book written by this. Who was this French guy?
Michel Picheval, who was the first white man, so he claims, to visit Lo Man Fang under a royal allowance by the King of Nepal. And he visited in 1966, and he was the first white man to go into Lo Man Fang.
Okay, so over 50 years ago, and does your experience corroborate with the description in his book? Does it feel very different, or can you relate to it?
It was remarkable reading his book, because he describes the walk up the valley and the things that we saw on the way. And it's sort of like as clear as looking back at my photographs. I remember that. Yes, that was still there. Yeah, oh, that's steeper. Yeah, amazing. I mean, the only difference that is happening now is there is a massive road that they're putting through the valley, which...
No, what? Through the valley you walked up?
Yeah, there's a big road construction going on, and they're connecting basically India with Tibet. Through Nepal, and the road, because the trail has been walked for thousands and thousands of years, that's basically where the road is going, and that's we came across big construction traffic, and as a tourist, it's a tragedy to see such scars on such a beautiful landscape. But as the local people, they welcome the road because they see it as an opportunity to bring tourists in and business and also the modern world. And they can go and get healthcare down in Kathmandu or Pokhara. They can... they all welcomed it. And occasionally you'd see the road sort of winding unnecessarily and you'd ask why that was. And they said, because that community... They want the road to go through that town so that they can have the benefit of it as well.
Sure.
Why not? It's all very well for us to say, what a shame.
You can relate to it. Of course you can relate to it. Yes, but it will substantially change Lo Man Tang, which is presumably its destination.
It goes beyond.
Oh, does it?
20 miles beyond Lo Man Tang is Tibet and the Chinese border.
But the road is it being financed by the Chinese?
Booked by the Indians.
That's what our guide said. Yes, it's financed by the Chinese.
Is it?
It's a massive cost. 500 billion rupees or something.
So Nepal, I would imagine, is being vied for between India and China, of course, the two superpowers. Excuse me, Nepal was always in the realm of India as being part of the British Empire and obviously Hindu, mainly Hindu. But do you feel the Chinese influence in Nepal?
No, not in Nepal itself, not at all. No, Nepal was like no other country I've been to, really. It was incredibly beautiful. I loved it, and I will return. I didn't know that some countries you go to, like in Africa, you see massive Chinese depots, enormous factories with flying Chinese flags and behind sort of chain-link fences and stuff, and Chinese work camps. But here, no, there was none of that, none of that. There was a kind of underlying presence of a very big neighbour.
Right, yes, okay. Sort of you could feel his breath kind of thing. And Gav, very quickly, I gather you had an exciting flight back in the small biplane from Johnson back to Pokhara.
You basically go to Johnson Airport and then you join the queue in the morning to get shuttled back down the mountain. And as I said earlier, you know, if you can get the earlier flight, then it's a little bit more stable. I think I managed to get on flight number 4, and I travelled with Nara, one of our lovely guides, and 13 Japanese or Chinese tourists. And, we hit a few very big air pockets coming out of the mountain. And this little aeroplane just disappeared and your stomach appeared above your head. And there was a lot of exclamation.
Nightmare, mate. We've got to leave you there because we're coming to the end of the show. It's been lovely having you. Thank you so much. Gavin Hogg talking to us in Wales. We're just in time to say goodbye.